The usual form in these things is that there's a long preamble setting out all of the ground that's going to be discussed, and then the discussion quite often is senseless after that. So I'll just begin with a question straight away. You were brought up in America, although you were born in Ireland, and your education in art during the 60s was during the period of what in retrospect is an incredibly interesting and important time, that of pop and minimalism. And then you came back over here to take up a job in the West Country in the mid-60s. Was there a big culture shock when you arrived?
Yes, there was an enormous culture shock, because I was at Yale, and which is in New Haven, which is about 90 miles from New York, and we went to New York every week. And so I saw all of those shows, because we were constantly going to New York, and I saw all the early pop shows and minimal shows, and lots of other things too, which in retrospect seem perhaps less interesting. And also it was, in a way, Britain now is much more like America was in 1966. And we lived by the kind of culture of the highway, the kind of North Circular culture of, things like, those big stores on the highway where you buy everything in push carts and everything. Everything is very available. And the first thing that struck me when coming to England was the incredible poverty of materials. Coming from America, there was so much stuff, and everything was so cheap, and it was so easy to get everything. And there was so much choice. If you wanted to get a hammer, there were 27 different kinds of hammer that you could get. And if you wanted a material like plywood, it was very, very cheap, and there were tons of different kinds. And here it was very hard to get these very, what to me were very basic materials. The reason I was using them in America was because they were cheap, basic materials. And suddenly I got here, and they weren't cheap, and they weren't basic. So it made a lot of difference. And the first effect it had was it changed the scale of what I did, because the things I'd been doing in America, even as a student, were bigger than the things that I did here, because the materials that I was used to were much more expensive here.
And was that actually a difference between the countries, or really between the city and the country?
It was partly because I had gone from essentially a very urban situation I was at Corsham, and it was a tiny West Country village. And, with the high street, my memory is of women with enormous prams trying to negotiate each other, going down the pavements of the high street, and which you don't see so much today. And so there was a country-city difference as well. But I think it would have been... There still would have been a big difference in the city.
Did you feel at that time, in any sense, that you were proselytizing, or that you ought to proselytize on behalf of what you'd left?
Well, on the one hand, I realized I was very familiar with a lot of things that were going on, very current things. And if you're familiar with such things, you don't think there's anything special about it. That's just what you know about. And then you go someplace where nobody knows anything about it, and you suddenly realize that it's kind of special, and you don't have anybody to talk to, because nobody's ever heard of any of the things that you're talking about. And except for people who saw magazines like Art Forum, nobody had ever seen any of the work that I was interested in. So that did make a lot of difference. I was very fortunate. There were several, in anybody's life, I suppose, there's kind of fortunate things that happen that change one's life. And I went to Corsham by chance. They offered me a job. It turned out to be a very interesting school. It was a wonderful time to be there. It was a very intriguing place, very bizarre to me. And there were very interesting people teaching there. And by far the most interesting person was Mark Lancaster. And Mark Lancaster had studied at Newcastle with Richard Hamilton, and Mark had also lived in New York, and he had worked at the factory with Andy Warhol. So there actually was somebody, and probably the only place in the country I could actually have met somebody who actually knew New York in that sense more intimately than I knew it, as a kind of distant, this kind of thing on the horizon that I would have loved to be part of, but was on the periphery of, and here was this person who had really had been in the midst of it. It still made, I still felt very separated from it, but it was a very good connection.
One of the things that I suppose has been talked about perhaps a lot more recently than hitherto is the very strong connection on all sorts of levels that actually exists between pop and minimalism, and that existed at that time, that they, although formally they might look quite different, in many ways they were dealing with very much the same kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Did you feel that there was any kind of role model for you in the sort of thing you were doing at that time? I mean, I'm thinking particularly of those early boxes, which have in one sense a very minimal look, but also in their utilitarian aspects, are quite homely and commodified.
Well, we had a very strong generational sense of ourselves, and I mean, so that to us, I mean, when I was, I suppose I was in my early 20s, but to me, the people who, pop artists, they were quite a bit older. And then there were the minimalists, they were a bit older. And then there was going to be us, and we weren't going to be pop artists because that was already there, and we weren't going to be minimalists because that was already there. And so our notion of art and our notion of ourselves and where our place was going to be in the scheme of things, it never occurred to us that we wanted to be pop artists or minimalists, because we assumed that all those people already, they already existed. I mean, in 1965, I mean, I knew the work of Sol DeWitt, Andre, Judd, Morris, all the people who are known today as the minimalists. I mean, I hadn't seen a great deal of it, and they weren't very well known, but we were aware of that, and we were very interested in all that, but, and we definitely saw ourselves as taking, as that holding some kind of lead. That was what we looked at. I mean, it seemed to me that, as I think it's true now, if you're a student, you look at, well, you kind of have to make a decision whether you're going to be interested in those things which are very current. Some students make a decision to do that and others don't. If you do, then you have a way of engaging with a whole historical scheme of things, and everything seems very related. I mean, I've always found it amazing. I've sometimes been accused by people, and or have know people who think of themselves as being traditionalists, or the kind of honoring tradition, think of people like me as kind of breaking with tradition, you know, kind of, you know, hating history and kind of wanting to, you know, whereas actually I consider that what I do is a complete, just total continuity of everything in Western art, and that in order to have that continuity, one had to do something that was radical. That to me, the notion of being traditional was to be radical. That was your duty. And if you wanted to be like the people that you admired, you had to do something completely different from them, because the worst way of honoring them or acknowledging them was to do something that looked like what they did. So you had to do something different.
Mm. I'm very interested in the kind of feeling you have about that work now, say from the mid-60s up to the early 70s. One thing I think that is interesting about the opportunity that you've had with the show at the Whitechapel is that you've had to bring all of that work together. And one of the problems in doing that is that actually you lost a lot of it in the mid-70s. Mm-hmm. And so you've actually had to revisit it in quite a different sort of way, in actually physically redoing it. Did you find that a problem, or was it a mechanical thing just to say, well, I made that work and it looked like that, so I'll make it again?
Well, I mean, the funny thing is that the nature of what I do is so, it's so determined by given factors. I mean, all the boxes are 2 feet high. The reason all the boxes are 2 feet high is because plywood comes in 4x8 sheets, and it's the most economical unit that you can get. And if you're poor and you can't afford lots of sheets of plywood, you make things out of 2 foot units, so you can get the maximum number of bits out of a board. But that's very easy to remember. And so remaking things was terribly easy. And I mean, I do have photographs of all the early things, but also I found that I would try, I mean, some of them I have made myself. A lot of the pieces that have been remade have been remade by other people. Some of the original pieces were made by other people. And the thing that's been very odd is having work that I did, you know, this works I did 1968, 1969, 1970, 1972, 1973, all arriving new simultaneously. I mean, there were years between them all when I did them, and there were lots of ones that weren't really very good in between them, and only the good ones have come back, which is very interesting. The best have come back, and they've all come back simultaneously, and they're all brand new. So it's very strange for me to see it all. It's kind of collapsed. My whole life feels like it's kind of been, collapsed into 1 year, into one. It all looks amazingly new to me. Of course, it looks very new to everybody else because, of course, it is new. But
was that a relief, being able to edit in that way, or did you feel that you were being slightly untrue to yourself by saying, well, I
can... No, of course I didn't feel true. No, I mean, any exhibition you choose work, and you obviously, if you're going to have, just a fraction of what I've done, I chose all the best things. I didn't put in things I didn't think were very good. I just soon forget them.
Mm-hmm. The kind of questioning that went on in conceptualism about what art was, about what it could be, about what the fundamental aspects of the phenomena were that made it art rather than something else, crystallized in your work, I think, in this debate about the relationship between what is a picture and what is an object, about how one can actually have an object that is a picture, or how one takes an object to be a picture. Could you say something about that?
Well, I mean, in the first things, in the early work, I always had the idea. I'm very skeptical, and I need proof of everything. I don't believe anything on hearsay, and I like to see for myself. I like to work it out. And I mean, all this kind of skepticism that any ordinary, the man on the street has about art, I feel like I have too. And so the objects that I thought were kind of credible were real objects. I felt like it was easier to believe in tables and chairs than it was in sculptures. And they obviously had an awful lot in common, and there was also obviously this very big difference. And so, although a lot of what I've done has, I mean, I suppose everything I've done has been about art, I've never really done it. I've tried not to do it. Well, I haven't tried. I don't think I've done it in terms of art about art. It's been art through things, about trying to find out about art through things which aren't art. Because somehow they seem to me to be the kind of model of what art things were. And if you go back far enough, there isn't any art, there's just things. The distinction, but for people that live in caves, was there was no art. Everything was treated, seems to be much more similarly. And so that intrigued me about how a thing was what it was. And I kind of I think it's just fascinating the way something kind of holds together as itself. And most things do that by being a type. You know, if you say a table, there's all sorts of, I mean, there's even weird ones like this, but there are tables, when we say table, we all have an idea, so it's quite easy to think about table or to make a table because we all have this notion. If you're making a sculpture, it's like trying to do the same thing but without the notion. You don't have that generic thing, but you're actually trying to do something that's just like a table, but you don't have that general thing. So that seemed very intriguing to me. Mm. And then, dealing with things like that, then I just got interested then in the idea of how you got from things into images of things. And the thing that ended up interesting me was just the very simple fact of being able to tell that a picture of something is the thing that you think it's the picture of, which seems to me to be more interesting than anything else about things. I mean, that seems to me to be very, very strange. And it seems to me that everybody who did work that was pictorially representational took that for granted. when actually it's by far the most intriguing aspect of things. So that's kind of the key to all of the work I've done with wall drawings and the constructions and the paintings.
Hmm. I mean, with the wall drawings, a lot of the wall drawings, that idea of a sort of a generic form for something is quite evident. The idea that you almost stylize something to the extent that one really just doesn't think about it at all, like mm-hmm. it's a light bulb or it's a table, and you don't think, well, it's a certain kind of table like mm-hmm. that, it's just mm-hmm. whatever.
I would never draw this table.
No. One of the things that is interesting about the development between the earlier wall drawings and some of the works you've done in the 80s is that that kind of vocabulary of images that you've had and used have, as it were, kept pace with the times. And it seems to me that because the times themselves have been very style conscious, certain images have crept in that have that notion attached to them as well. For example, your use of things like televisions, items of clothing, and so on.
I mean, it's interesting. It seems to me one of the ways of kind of looking at what I've done is that I treat an awful lot of things which aren't the same as though they were the same. And I try to think about things which aren't the same as though they were the same. So I try to think of things that aren't equal as though they were equal. So I think of all of those things that I draw, they're all equal. And, of course, in life they're not equal, but I try to think, so that, and the drawing is a way of making them all equal. And if I use color, I try to think as color. Color is equal to drawing. Drawing is equal to book. So everything is equal. And each of those things carries with it all sorts of associations and information that have nothing to do with me. I mean, everybody's carrying it around with them. You know, you carry it with yourself, and everybody has it. And I would never draw anything that people couldn't recognize. If you can't recognize it the second you see it, I don't draw it. That's why I wouldn't draw this, because if I drew that, you'd think it was a drum or something like that. And that pause would be curtains for me. You need to be able to recognize it. There's things I like which I can't draw because you couldn't recognize them. And so things take on different kind of meanings in different kind of contexts. I mean, my whole idea of all that stuff is that I use the identical drawings. I mean, in the exhibition, there's a drawing of the globe. It is exactly the same drawing of the globe. It's not just the same globe, it's the same drawing. It appears in the wall drawing downstairs, the big red and black wall drawing upstairs. It appears in the blue globe with the box, and it appears in the black painting. And it's like, I can use the same thing, and it says something different every single time I use it. It carries something of itself, but it always carries different meaning depending on what I do to it, what kind of context I use, what I use with it, anything. I don't even have to think about it. I don't have to worry about it. It's like it kind of accrues to things. And so that I've tried, I mean, see, a lot of people like, now, because a lot of people haven't seen it before, because the earlier work, and I'm, of course, delighted that so many people now like it, when so few people liked it when I did it, and that's one, you know, it's absolutely thrilling. But the later work, which I think a lot of people have more trouble with, some people have more trouble with that, because it seems it's kind of artificial, and I use kind of bright colors, and all this. It's much more conventional in a sense. But that's because I've tried to apply the things that I did before to all those conventions. And so naturally they come out a bit like all those things, because I'm trying to get as close to I make those paintings because I want to get as close to the convention of painting as I can, and I think they're pretty weird as paintings, but I am trying to get close, which is quite different than what I was doing before, but I am trying to use the same methods of getting close to things. I've never had an idea about what to do, so I've always had to look. I don't have any kind of content idea. I don't know what to make anything about. So everything is always about what's already there. So whatever I decide I'm going to start with, that's what I've got. So if I decide I'm going to do neons, and that's the kind of decision, I think, oh, I'll do neons. And then from that, I start to think about, well, what do you get with neon? Then I think, well, there's on and off, and there's that. So then you need various things on and what could on and off means movement or change. Or something. So then, and then I start to need imagery to make those things happen. But I don't think of the ideas and then put them into neon. It's like the other way around. And it's always internal, so that with the paintings, I just figure, okay, you want to do painting, so you've got to have a canvas, you've got to have stretches, you have to have at least two colors, you know, so and you need an image. Okay, so that's all I've got, and you kind of see what you do with what, and it doesn't matter an awful lot about anything else. Is that
right? One of the equivalences that one could draw in that sequence that you said would be between objects and elements in language. Is that one that has been of interest to you?
Yeah, very, very, very interesting. Very interesting about language and objects, because I have language is so fabulous. You know, like I can say, I'm going to say a sentence now, and I'm going to say the other side of the moon is very dark, just like the bottom of the ocean and the color of my socks. So in one sentence, we've gone from the other side of the moon to the bottom of the ocean to my socks, and I got them all into one sentence. All those notions, those enormously different notions, can be collapsed. Language can kind of collapse those things into one sentence, which is just amazing. And I think that images allow the same images. The images that I've tried to use, I use them like language, and they can do the same kind of things. And you can do things with images and language you cannot do with things. That's why the wall drawings allow me to make things gigantic and transparent and all sorts of things. Hey, you can't do that with real things. They're very resistant. So, but you can do it. The second you turn it into language in this kind of way, then suddenly they're very flexible. And that seems to me to be kind of crucial, kind of like crucially human. And there must have been a time when people were inventing language more than we do. Or maybe we still do, I don't know. And I feel like art is like, the act of art is the equivalent of constantly inventing language. It's like keeping the problem of making language alive, keeping it going, that it can never stop. So, because art is the way in which you keep making language happen. And I think they're very equivalent, images and thing and words. So I think of the things in terms of naming.
I suppose the piece for which you're most notorious is an oak tree. Do you ever find that its notoriety is a problem in terms of the way that people could look at the other work?
Well, I mean, fortunately, I like the piece very much. I mean, I'm delighted that I did it. And I loved it from the minute I first did it, and I still love it. But it does focus people's attention. But then, of course, I mean it to, and it is very extraordinary and it's very extreme. And it functions in the way it does is part of its success. I mean, it's supposed to. But I have to say, I mean, in the exhibition, I put it first so that it has a space kind of to itself. And it's the introduction, it kind of says everything I've ever wanted to say about anything. It's all there. And you see it first, and then you go around that wall, and then you don't have to think about it again, because you get on with the rest of the exhibition, and it's kind of over. So it's kind of like a way of having it both at the center of the exhibition and also slightly excluding it, so it doesn't dominate everything else. You don't have to see it again until you leave, even. Well, of course, when I did the first show, lots of people came to the exhibition, didn't even see it on the wall. The people, you know, thought there was there's no show. And I've noticed quite a few people going into the White Shop go right past it the same way, and they miss it this time. So it's obviously the very similar situation.
Mm. It obviously brings up the question of faith in relation to art, the act of making art. Mm. And the insistence that the viewer believe, quite forcefully, that what you say is the case, is the case. How far would you allow religious language to come into that discussion?
I don't like art being talked of like a religious like a replacement for religion. I mean, I don't even like metaphysics. But I do think that there are certain notions there which are possible in terms of how one understands what it is to deal with anything. I mean, it seems to me we have a convenient notion that there's a difference between knowledge and belief. But actually, everything that we think we know is 90% or more beliefs. Sometimes it's 100% belief. I mean, I've never been to China, and you know, it's that thing you're told when you're a kid, but is it really there? Well, yes, it is. But it's because I believe all the other people who say it is, but I'm not absolutely sure. And so it seems to me that's part of how one understands everything in the world, and that one of the things about, you know, you can't, if you start to withdraw belief from things, you know, this is my foot, and if I start to really wonder about it, I am in a lot of trouble. I'm going crazy. And whereas if with works of art, it's the one area of belief where you can choose not to believe, and you're not going to go crazy. I mean, this is not, you can decide that Carl André is not a work of art. It's rubbish, that's it. And you know, it's not the end of the world. It's not, you know, you're not going crazy. Maybe foolish, but you're not crazy.
And yet, surely your entire endeavor, all of that work is about, I don't know, allowing people to believe, asking them to believe, suggesting that they do, persuading them to believe that really it is a work of art.
Of course, of course. But that, as an artist, of course, that is what one's endeavor is. And I mean, I've done a lot of things where I try to kind of trick people into engagement. You know, it's like the boxes. I mean, I had the box piece. One of the reasons why I made the boxes so they open and closed was because I figured that anybody who was already opening and closing something was already in such intimate relation with it that they had to kind of believe in it. You know, it's like, it was like a better belief than just looking at it. If you were really kind of touching, you were making something happen. But I mean, it does seem to me that if you, it's like the way in which things are real to people in art is very, it's very personal. And if you say to me, this such and such is the greatest work of art, you're just crazy about it, it's a fabulous thing, and I really don't like it, or I think it's terrible. So I'm withholding belief from it, which is basically what one's doing. Well, there is no kind of fact that says you're right and I'm wrong, or I'm right and you're wrong. It is hinging on that. And I do think a lot of what I've done is to just try to find areas of doubt about ordinary human things that people think are natural or God-given or true, when nearly everything in the world is invented by us for our convenience. So we can think about things in a more convenient way.
Did you, or have you enjoyed getting as close to that edge of rejection as, in a sense, you could go? I mean, that comes out through all of them, not only in an oak tree, but, say, in the balance pieces, where on the table piece with the buckets on top of it, it is such a graphic representation of a tautology that mm-hmm. you just take one thing away and the whole thing collapses. Mm-hmm. That in a sense you're almost inviting people the other way around not to believe in you.
Well, I mean, it's very funny. When I first did the oak tree and I wrote the interview and everything, at the time I was very close to Barry Flanagan, and I phoned Barry and I said, Barry, I've just done this fabulous piece, you've got to come over and see it. So Barry came over and he looked at the glass of water and I showed him the interview and he read the interview and he didn't smile or anything, and I thought, you know, what's wrong? And he just looked at me and he said, it's terrible. And I said, what do you mean it's terrible? He said, you've given away all the trade secrets. And I think I kind of do. I kind of deal in the trade secrets, and I kind of reveal them all. It's like, you know, like that's, you can see it happening. You know, it's like I'm trying to trick you, but I want to show you how the trick is done at the same time. I want you always to be able to see. So you'd know it's a trick, that it's done. And it's like, that's what holds the things together. I mean, I don't think that they're necessarily what the things are about. It's like trying to find some reason why, you know why a table has four legs, because it's got to stand up. And there isn't some kind of, there isn't a generic justification for a sculpture having or a work of art having a certain form. So it has to have an internal reason why it has to be as it is. So I've used that kind of thing. And I remember the first work that I ever did as a student where I thought this is really interesting was the first time when I did something and I thought, I can't make it any better. It was a kind of dumb thing that just did what it did. And the minute it did what it did, I knew it was finished. And everything I had ever done as a student before then, I never knew whether it was finished or not. It always seemed kind of tentative. It was kind of, you know, I could be a bit more this, or a bit more, it might be a bit brighter, it might be a bit bigger, it might be, I don't know. Whatever I was doing, it always seemed, and suddenly I did something and it was complete. And I think that if you look at my work, that's a kind of, I know when I've got it, because it's, which some people find offensive.